Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, Canadians celebrated Emancipation Day on August 1st all across the country. Many took part in the 10th Freedom Train Ride event at Union Station in Toronto, for example. And in Nova Scotia, the Dalhousie Art Gallery celebrated Emancipation Day with the Secret Codes quilt exhibit.
I don't think we learn enough about the history of African Nova Scotians, about the history of enslavement in Canada, in Nova Scotia. And this is a very powerful way to walk through the art gallery and see the stories being told.
We'll dive into Bill C-18, which is creating quite a stir. Some big tech companies, Facebook and Google in particular, already say they will not comply. Ottawa's trying to reach an agreement with them. Alex Friedman, Executive Director of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, helps us better understand what's at stake.
Facebook and Google have built a massive financial model on the ability to create conversations around the news that we Canadian journalists generate. Because, dear Facebook and Google, you've made such a fortune off of this, it's only right that you reinvest a small portion of what you've made off of this into the Canadian journalism system.
And to close the show, we'll meet with a blind man who swam 30 kilometers across the Georgia Strait in Nanaimo, BC. Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for being with us. We start the show in the Maritimes with a rendezvous at the Dalhousie Art Gallery, which celebrated Emancipation Day with the Secret Codes quilt exhibit. Emancipation Day was officially recognized in Canada in 2021 after a unanimous vote by members of Parliament, and every August 1st will now mark the day when the Slavery Abolition Act came into effect across the British Empire, including Canada, in 1834. The quilts on exhibit at the Art Gallery were used as coded communication for people escaping slavery. They would often be hung in windows and over clotheslines for people to follow as directions, as well as give warnings of dangers along the journey. As part of the celebration at the Art Gallery, families of African Nova Scotian descent who had quilts in their possession were also invited to tell their own family stories. The Secret Codes exhibit has been touring across the country since January 2023. It is currently shown at the Dalhousie Art Gallery until August 6, the final stop in the tour. Haley DiRizio met up with Barbara Hamilton Hinge, Assistant Vice Provost of Dalhousie's Office of Equity and Inclusion in Halifax, co-sponsor of the event.
As the Equity Office, one of our mandates is to promote, encourage, and support equity, diversity, and inclusion on this campus. And so being invited to be a sponsor of the Secret Code in the last week is very important to us. So the collaboration is really important to us. It's important for us as an office to be seen as being visible and engaged, particularly in issues relevant to equity, diversity, and inclusion on this campus. As you may be aware, the Third Century Promise, the strategic plan for the Third Century Promise, has a strong focus on African Nova Scotians and Mi'kmaq students and faculty and staff. And so the Secret Code really brings into light the historical experience of people of African descent from the diaspora and their relation to Nova Scotia. And having had the pleasure to go on the walking tour already of the Secret Codes, you can see the stories of the African Nova Scotians. You can see the stories of people of African descent who came to this place that is known as Turtle Island. And so the exhibit itself doesn't just have the Secret Codes. It also has some very powerful art images done by various artists, both from Nova Scotia. An artist who also recently came here from Nigeria has a couple pieces in it. Some local artists, such as Letitia Frazier, has some paintings in it. And so it was actually breathtaking to see how quilting was used as a way to support people of African descent who are coming and seeking freedom in Canada. That's not to say that slavery did not exist in Canada. Slavery existed right here in Nova Scotia. But to see the fact that we had quilters who were doing designs based on symbols that represented freedom, that represented emancipation, And on display is a quilt that's over 100 years old. And it looks like it was just, you know, made within the past year. And so the quality of these quilts is just breathtaking. And to see some of the work that has been designed by David Woods. And so as he talked about, he's an artist and a painter, as well as a poet, you know, many, many talents. And some of the weavers have taken, or some of the quilt makers have taken his work and made it into quilts. And every quilt has a story. Every quilt has a theme. And I don't think we learn enough about the history of African Nova Scotians, about the history of enslavement in Canada, in Nova Scotia. And this is a very powerful way to walk through the art gallery and see the stories being told. And having been part of being a part of the Equity Inclusion Office and being connected to the African Nova Scotian strategy, having been pivotal in the development of the Lord Dalhousie Report that talks about the involvement or the connection of people being enslaved and its connection to the Lord Dalhousie, really speaks to even more so why we need to be a part of it.
With the exhibit happening on, or I guess the event happening on Emancipation Day, how do you think how does the quilting really resonate with having it on that day?
Yeah. I think, first of all, I think it's important that Canada is recognizing Emancipation Day. And even more so that Nova Scotia has been the lead in getting it acknowledged and seen in Senate through our own Dr. Wanda Thomas Bernard. And the fact that the art gallery is opening up and really having a public viewing and walking through and showcasing on Emancipation Day allows people of African descent to quietly and reflectively walk through the art gallery, hear about the experiences of people of African descent who have been enslaved, learn about the activism, the secret activism that took place in helping people to become emancipated, to see the work of young artists who have developed such a strong connection to themselves as people of African descent, and to that part of our history of having been enslaved is important. And I think that the gallery and the secret code is open to every age. Every quilt tells a story that is important. Every quilt represents a part of the history of people of African descent. And I was very fascinated to learn about the different symbols and some of the quilts that use the symbol and how there's different messages in the symbol. Some call Jacob's Ladder, some looking at following the North Star, some looking at just different points that would, there was one that had different directions that was indicated so that if people were being chased and they would know to scatter and go into different parts. So even seeing the representation of the symbols that tell a story through the secret codes speaks to the importance of not forgetting our history, of learning from our history, of recognizing the strength of people of African descent and their knowledge and skills that they had to develop these types of codes to support other people of African descent.
And Emancipation Day was just something that started being recognized in Canada in 2021. So obviously this is sort of a newer event. Do you think this will continue into the future, maybe with other gallery, exhibitions going on in the future?
Absolutely. And other celebrations. One of my colleagues yesterday said, we need to have a big celebration on August 1st for Emancipation Day. We shouldn't just be having big celebrations during African Heritage Month, but we also need to really have bigger celebrations in this province. And people are doing different events on Emancipation Day. And so I'm hoping that we will continue to elevate August 1st as Emancipation Day and continue to educate others about the history of people of African descent in this country and their contributions that they have made despite parts of their history.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Canadian news and media outlets are facing new challenges with the passing of Bill C-18. The bill, also called the Online News Act, was intended to be a new bargaining framework to support media outlets and to secure fair compensation when their news content is made available on social media and search engines such as Facebook, Instagram, and Google. The bill was passed by the Canadian government on June 22, 2023, but on the same day, Meta said it had no intention to comply. Their response was, "Today we're confirming that news availability will be ended on Facebook and Instagram for all users in Canada prior to the Online News Act Bill C-18 taking effect. This means that Canadians relying on social media to get links to their favorite news will not be able to do so." In response, some Canadian media, municipalities, private companies, and the government itself pulled out their advertising from Facebook. To better understand the implications of Bill C-18 and the arguments of both sides, BC journalist Pamela Hassan reached out to Alex Friedman, executive director of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, CRFC. The CRFC, as you know, also produces this show, Viewpoints, as well as its French counterpart, Point de Vue. Pamela and Alex both try to better understand why the government feels the big tech companies need to pay their fair share, and also why some GAFAs, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, are resisting it by blocking links to Canadian news outlets from their platforms.
It's part of a couple of important bills that were introduced by, well, now previous Heritage Minister Pablo Rodriguez. But this has been part of the government agenda for some time. And the reality is that the Broadcasting Act and the rules that govern the broadcasting system haven't changed in more than 30 years. And, you know, put into perspective, you know, they just really invented the smartphone 30 years ago. I think we were all still playing like ColecoVision at the time. I mean, it's a long time ago, you know? And so because really the broadcasting world has changed so much, they did a couple of important things. One, C-11, which we're not going to talk about so much today, but it is important because it was the one that went first, updated the Broadcasting Act to say that, like commercial broadcasters who, for the longest time, because they profit off of Canadians and don't really invest in Canadian voice, have to then allocate a portion of their earnings, what they get as a result of broadcasting to a Canadian audience, to support the Canadian broadcasting system. And that, well, was, until recently, the more controversial piece of legislation. Now, C-18 also says a similar thing. It says, you know, dear internet broadcasters, and particularly in this case, we're really just talking about Google and Meta or Facebook because of the scope of their operations and how much they benefit from Canadian news content. But it says, look, you for so long, because, you know, as we say in communications, content is king. So you've benefited for so long from the content provided by Canadian news outlets. And not to say that Canadian news outlets don't also benefit from being rebroadcast on Facebook and Google, but Facebook and Google have built a massive financial model on the ability to create conversations around the news that we Canadian journalists generate. Mm-hmm. And so because, dear Facebook and Google, you've made such a fortune off of this, it's only right that you reinvest a small portion of what you've made off of this into the Canadian journalism system. And so that's what C-18 is. It's a piece of legislation that says that because of the scope of what they've been able to earn, that they should reinvest in those news outlets whose content has been used by Google and Facebook, and also who've been impacted by the fact that Google and Facebook take up so much advertising in the advertising market. And so that's essentially what C-18 is.
Okay, thanks so much for that. It's nice to hear it explained with also the pieces, like not only the pieces of legislation involved, but also just an understanding of sort of both sides and how this came to be, and that this obviously is, like you mentioned, we're in such a new landscape for media now that working with companies and new systems for publication are just changing so fast. So legislation kind of is always going to take a little bit of time to keep up with it.
Absolutely. And you know, for what it's worth, both of these pieces of legislation went through the House and the Senate at a snail's pace relative to other pieces of legislation. I mean, there was a lot of analysis done on this. There was a lot of studying done on this. And there was a lot of testimony heard about both of these pieces of legislation. So it's not as though they went through kind of willy-nilly. And both pieces of legislation had the support of the NDP, the Liberals, the Bloc, and the Green Party. It was really only the Conservative Party that spoke out against these pieces of legislation.
Mm-hmm. And the Department of Canadian Heritage, they've also said that they'll draft like regulations specifying the application of Bill C-18 and provide guidance on implementing it. Do we know at all what these regulations will be?
No. And the way Heritage worked under Minister Rodriguez, and this changes from minister to minister, by the way, but the way Heritage worked under Minister Rodriguez is once a bill received royal assent, so went through first, second, and third reading, Senate, House, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then got the approval to become law. At that point, the government then puts out a series of what they call policy direction. And this says, dear, in this case, CRTC, or dear regulator, now that we've passed this legislation, here's what I, as minister, expect you to do with it. So we've seen the policy direction for C-11. That's open for 45 days of public consultation, but we've not yet seen the policy direction for C-18. Interesting, because of the cabinet shuffle, the very, very recent cabinet shuffle, we will now have a new Heritage Minister, Pascal Saint-Onge, who will have the duty to direct the regulators around what C-18 and how it should be applied. But this is a very prescriptive piece of legislation, and the legislation itself doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room for interpretation. So it's pretty clear what they're supposed to do with it.
Mm-hmm. And now, kind of knowing that the end user being the listener and the reader, that they are going to be the people that really do rely on things like social media, Facebook and Google, and website traffic is not the same as finding something in a feed that you're already, it's just coming at you at the pace that Facebook does. So are Canadian news outlets involved in talks about what solutions that Meta in a statement released said that they're looking at as a way to build an effective product solution? Do you feel that Canadian news outlets are involved in these talks about what these solutions might look like?
Some are. We know that well before C-18 was passed, Meta and Google reached agreements with some of the major newspapers, i.e. the Torstar Group. I'm sure we know they reached an agreement with the Globe and Mail, with Postmedia. And so they've gone to, and this is same as happened in Australia, because this legislation was modeled on a piece of legislation that was originally passed in Australia. They have made deals and agreements with the major broadcasters. And while I'm not in the room for them, one presumes that those broadcasters are also part of the conversation right now about how it will be applied. Throughout the course of this, we worked hard to ensure that the way it works is basically once the government is satisfied that the Google and Facebook have reached agreements with enough broadcasters and media outlets that it's essentially the majority. And that number is not prescribed. We don't know clearly what the majority looks like. But once they've made a deal with enough broadcasters, they will then get what's called an exemption order. In other words, they will then be allowed to carry on doing their business and they will be seen as in compliance with the law. So they will have had conversations with those outlets, I presume, with whom they have already reached agreements. We at the Community Radio Fund and with the associations that legislate or that work with the majority of the community radio stations, we've not yet had a sit down with them. We're hoping to sit down with them to try and help them draft a policy that would benefit them and the broadcasters, but we've not yet had that conversation.
Smaller news outlets like us, like, is there a timeline? Do we know when I'm going to call it the hammer is going to drop?
We don't. There's a lot of mystery around when that impact will be felt. We do know that some community radio stations have already felt the hammer. Mm. It's not hard to figure out who's a licensed community radio station, campus radio station, Indigenous radio station in Canada. But no, we don't know when it will fully come into effect. The law itself is not entirely in effect until the CRTC does its consultation. We'd always assumed that they would wait until the law functionally went into effect. before applying these measures. But I've seen on my own Facebook feed saying they've already done it to a number of outlets. And I've seen outlets complain that their stories have already been blocked again on social media. So I can't give you a timeline for this. I think it's, you know, in Australia, they did this. And then there was a significant pushback, public pushback. And they did ultimately largely reverse the decision to do it. So I don't know if this is a bluff, if this is a positioning, you know, standpoint or something. It's hard to say what's going to happen. And certainly none of us have a roadmap for how long they're going to take to fully implement their boycott or whatever you want to call it. But again, for the sake of democracy, we hope that they don't actually follow through with this and that we are all able to sit down and come up with a good solution. Of course, we've seen major media outlets now back out in terms of their advertising on Google and Facebook. We've also seen the federal government. The federal government invested millions and millions and millions of dollars in Facebook and Google, all the while saying they wanted to make sure that Google and Facebook were paying for what they were, you know, what they were taking out of the Canadian economy. Yep. And so there was a certain irony there. They now have done this. And we're also seeing a number of municipalities have votes around whether or not they too should pull their Facebook and Google advertising. And I'll just touch on this one important point that, you know, if municipalities go down that road, it's not about the sum total of the dollar figure they withdraw from Google and Facebook, in so much as it's a message that says, you know, we value local journalism. And to that extent, we will stop advertising on you if you are going to use local journalism as a pawn in your bid for profits. And so this is a really important message. But, you know, it is important that those who do currently advertise on Google and Facebook and who believe in Canadian journalism make a stand now and say that this is just not an acceptable solution. You know, we've seen their advertisement on Facebook saying, well, in order to be compliant with the law, we've got to do this. Well, that's not true. They could also pay their fair share and stay compliant with the law. You know, it's not a one-sided conversation. And we do hope that, as I say, we can work together with them to come to a good solution for them.
Absolutely. And I mean, to be frank, too, it's any angle that you look at this, it's not an easy black and white answer of what's the correct thing to do or not. Because even if councils are speaking about standing up for local journalism, you know, as a local journalist, of course, I appreciate that. And I'm on that side. However, knowing that Facebook and Google are a way that people get very important and up-to-date information, especially now with Twitter being a paid service, I feel, you know, you feel so torn in this. And so, yeah, it's definitely a very pivotal time to be listening and having these conversations. And I think that's why I really appreciate you taking the time, especially on vacation, to speak with me today.
Well, what I would say to that last point, and I think it's a really good one, right? We do have to have balance. But if we are going to rely on social media for our information, we need to know that the voices of professional journalists are part of that information ecosystem and not just the cheapest available.
That was Alex Friedman, Executive Director of the CRFC, speaking with journalist Pamela Hassan. And to close the show, we quickly travel out west to Nanaimo, British Columbia, where we'll meet up with Scott Rees, who just finished a 30-kilometer swim across the Georgia Strait on July 30th. Scott Rees couldn't see who was yelling to greet him on shore at the end of his 11-hour open water marathon swim. This because he's completely blind. Rees has a recessive genetic eye condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which has caused a gradual loss of his vision over the past 15 years. Rees swam the distance for a cause. Rees's Swim the Strait campaign has raised over $127,000 for the Canadian Guide Dogs for the Blind. Journalist Mick Sweetman was waiting for Scott Rees as he came out of the water from a swim.
Yeah, I just swam across the Georgia Strait, which was a huge project for me. I've been training all year to do this as a fundraiser for the Canadian Guide Dogs for the Blind, and it feels great to have it behind me now.
And how was it out there?
It was really good at the start and at the end, and it was pretty tough in the middle. There was a bit more chop and currents that I wasn't expecting, and I had a couple of kilometers that took me a long time, a lot longer than I expected, and kind of threw off my rhythm, and my arms got pretty sore. But all in all, pretty happy with it.
How did it feel to make landfall?
Oh, it felt great. I was a little wobbly at first few steps onto the beach, but it feels nice to be back on dry ground here for sure. And enjoying a guide dog session ale as a celebration drink. It's really cool to have all these people out supporting the cause and supporting me on the swim.
What was the hardest part of it for you?
It was in the middle, but maybe the hardest part was having to postpone from yesterday to today, and then not getting a very good sleep last night, kind of anticipating the whole thing. I've been up since about 3 a.m. You just have that anxiety before you do something like this that you can't really shake until you're done. That's the hardest part. It's just getting yourself into the water and getting started.
Was there ever a moment where you thought you might not be able to continue?
I was struggling a bit with my shoulders in the middle, and I was hoping that they wouldn't give out on me because I was feeling pretty sore for the second half of the swim, really. But luckily, it kind of just stabilized and it didn't get too much worse, so I was able to just push through the discomfort of it. But yeah, I did have some anxiety out there thinking that my shoulders might give out on me.
Before I came up to you, I saw you talking with some of the people from the blind community here. How has that been? How has it been to get that support down here on the beach?
Yeah, it's really nice. I mean, my brother is one of those guys. He's visually impaired like myself and has a guide dog to support him.
Tim Reese is Scott's older brother, who grew up with him swimming as part of the Williams Lake Bluefin Swim Club.
I pretty much told him it's a crazy idea, that there was a good chance he'd get eaten by an orca.
And what do you think now?
I still think it's insane, but I'm glad he didn't get eaten by an orca.
Reese says that the support he got for the swim, including from his family and guide dog Caleb, made the 10-hour ordeal worth it.
Yeah, I just want to thank everybody out there, friends, family, and the general public that has gotten behind this fundraiser campaign. It's been a huge project, and it's been really successful from a fundraising perspective and also an awareness perspective. People were really supportive, so I owe everybody a big thanks.
And that's all for us at Viewpoints. We hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks to our team of journalists, Haley DiRizio, Pamela Hassan, and Mick Sweetman, national coordinators Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer. Thanks for keeping us company. Until next week, ciao.
News online at canada-info.ca.